Well, this morning we approach our third message from the book of Psalms with backstories. And today we're still in the early part of David's life when he first begins to be hunted by King Saul. So we're going to look at two Psalms, mainly Psalm 59, but also the 11th Psalm along these lines. Most of you know who Betsy Ten Boom is. Let me just remind you of what it was like to be Betsy Ten Boom, okay? She was born in 1885. When she was 3 years old, of course, she wouldn't have any memory of this, I suppose. But when she was 3 years old, her baby brother died, so the family had some hardship. When she was in childhood, it became apparent that she had chronic congenital anemia. She was always weak and dizzy, and they didn't really know why, but she was not strong. And then in her teen years, she was told that she wouldn't be able to bear children because she was just too weak. And so she chose at that time to not marry as well, since she couldn't have a proper family. And that must have been a big disappointment, right? At 29 years old, World War I broke out, and even though Holland, she's raised in Holland, even though Holland was neutral in World War I, it still caused food shortages and nervousness around the country. In 1918, when she's 33 years old, the Spanish flu broke out. So you remember, first World War I, and then the Spanish flu on its heels. And so she watched many of her neighbors die. 20,000 people died directly because of the Spanish flu, and others indirectly, comorbidities, as we call them now. And so that, in a little nation, Holland is only about the size of West Virginia geographically. Then when she is 36 years old, her mom died, relatively young, 63 years old, and her mom died. At 46 years old, the Great Depression started. And so, once again, hardship and political instability in Holland. Then when she's 55 years old, Germany occupied Holland. You remember, they were under Nazi control. And so there she is, under Nazi control at that time as well. At 56 years old, Germany is occupying Holland, and at 56, she is part of the underground resistance protecting Jewish people. Then at 58 years old, they begin to actually shelter Jewish people in their home. At 59 years old, in 1944, she was arrested with the rest of her family and brought to Ravensbrück concentration camp, and she died there that year. So she was only 59 years old. She never saw her 60th birthday. This is Betsy Ten Boom's Psalms life. It sounds just like what we're looking at today. Lots of hardship, lots of enemies, lots of scary things going on. And Betsy had to live through that. And so today we come to the 59th Psalm. And sometimes you might feel like your life is hard, like Betsy Ten Boom, and you might relate to this psalm. The superscription, the title of the psalm, above the psalm, it says, "To the chief musician, El Tashith." And that means, "Do not destroy. Don't destroy." And then it goes on. It says, "This is a miktam psalm." Miktam evidently means golden. This is a golden psalm. This is a treasure. Don't destroy. This is a treasure. And then the conditions. This is the psalm that David wrote and sang when Saul sent and they watched the house to kill him. So David is still a kid, basically, and Saul is trying to kill him. Saul being the most important person in his life as king of Israel. And Saul wants David dead. Now, we know about this not only from the title of the psalm, but from 1 Samuel 19:11. And here's what it says. "Saul also sent messengers to David's house to watch him and to kill him in the morning." So it's in that backstory that we have the 59th psalm. Now, just a quick theology before we get into that. When you are reading in the Old Testament, no matter where you are in the Old Testament, basically, you're going to see that the great and unceasing question was whether the Israelite nation could push back their own corruption and corrupt propensities and push back their enemies far enough and long enough so that they could have peace on earth, like the Christmas angels promised. But they had to obey the Lord for a long time and push the enemies back for that to happen. And they kept disobeying the Lord, so it was postponed and delayed over and over again. And then, of course, if they would have obeyed the Lord, then, as Deuteronomy 26 puts it, they would have been a special people high above all nations on earth. It would have been wonderful, you know, the golden age. So that was the question. But that's not how it is for us, mostly. Unlike the psalmist, when we're reading in the Psalms, we sometimes have a hard time connecting with what these psalms are all about. We would say, perhaps, that these psalms seem irrelevant to us because Saul isn't surrounding our house with messengers to ambush us when we walk out the front door. So you say, well, I have nothing in common with this psalm. But sit tight, you do, because you live in the Mystery Church Age of Grace. And that means that we are only trying to defend two territories. Remember, for David, the real possibility was that he'd be captured, right, abducted, and killed. You probably, in your whole life, have never even known anybody who is abducted. In your whole life, you've probably never even seen anybody that was killed. You didn't ever see a killing. And so you think, well, this psalm has nothing for me. But in the Mystery Church Age, you still have territories that you are supposed to defend and capture for the Lord. The first of these territories is your own personal spiritual life and integrity, because you have enemies who are always trying to knock you off balance with that. So you have a territory that you have to capture and defend. And you have another one too, and that's your gospel influence, your gospel rescue, your good impact in the world. And you have an enemy constantly trying to knock you off track so that you don't influence anybody for good. And that's very real. So when you read the Psalms, you are, in some sense, just like David, who was being harassed and his life was threatened. All right, now, we know that you have enemies, even if they're invisible, and most of your enemies are invisible. All of your most consequential enemies are invisible. Now, you might have some human enemies besides, but your most important enemies are invisible. We know that from Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10. Remember, finally, my brothers, be strong in the Lord in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, because this is really scary. So put on every piece of the armor of God so that you may be able to stand against the deceptions of the devil. In verse 12, for we are not wrestling against flesh and blood. So David was, right? We have flesh and blood men who are ready to ambush him when he walks out his front door. So he did have flesh and blood enemies. For the most part, we don't. And yet, we do have plenty of enemies, because these invisible enemies are very, very threatening all the time. And this never lets up. There is extreme pressure all the time on all of God's people. So when the psalmist says, the soldiers of neighboring nations are trying to capture and kill me, you say, evil spirits in my field of acquaintance, that is, the ones who are around me, the ones who know my name, those evil spirits, and sometimes in partnership with humans that they inspire to harm me, evil spirits in my field of acquaintance are trying to trick me and bully me back into darkness, deflect away all my best prospects for eternal rewards, and deflect away all my best prospects for showing my love for God. I am constantly being ambushed, and this never ends. So again, in Ephesians chapter 6, the Apostle Paul says, we are in the present tense, like right now. When you woke up this morning, you were at war. And when you go to bed tonight, you'll still be at war. We are not wrestling against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and the rulers of the darkness of this world. And you woke up to that this morning, and you'll go to bed with that same thing happening. So it's very real, even though it's a little different than David's situation. Once again, our background then is to this psalm, that Saul has sent men to David's house to kill him when he walks out the front door. Here's what it sounds like in 1 Samuel. This is the backstory to Psalm 59. Saul sought to strike David even to the wall with a javelin. He threw a spear at David, trying to kill him. But David slipped away out of Saul's presence, and he stuck the javelin into the wall, and David fled and escaped that night. Saul also sent messengers unto David's house to watch him and to kill him in the morning. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you shall be killed. So Michal let David down through the window, and he went out and fled and escaped. And Michal took an image and laid it in the bed and put a pillow of goat's hair for his headrest and covered it with a cloth. And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, he is sick. And Saul sent the messengers again to see David, saying, bring him up to me in the bed so that I may kill him. And when the messengers had come in, behold, there was an image in the bed with a pillow of goat's hair for his headrest. And Saul said to Michal, why have you deceived me and sent away my enemy so that he's escaped? And Michal answered Saul, he said to me, let me go. Why should I kill you? She's covering for him. He didn't say that. And Michal answered Saul, he said to me, let me go. Why should I kill you? So David fled and escaped and came to Samuel in Ramah and told Samuel all that Saul had done. And then there's this series of events. First of all, Saul tries to catch David while he's talking to Samuel, while he's en route talking and trying to pursue. He becomes overcome by the Holy Spirit and he prophesies. He didn't intend to do that. And David gets away. David has a secret meeting with Jonathan, Saul's son. And then Jonathan confirms that his dad is indeed trying to kill David. So in chapter 20, verse 38, and Jonathan cried after the lad. This is his armor bearer, a young lad, and they, Jonathan and David, have worked out a code. If everything is clear, I'll tell the lad to come to me. If everything is not okay, I'm going to tell the lad that the arrow I shot is far away. So that's the code, and David knows the code. All right, and Jonathan shot the arrow, and he cried after the lad, make haste, hurry, do not stay. And Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came to his master. And Jonathan said to David, go in peace. And he rose up and departed. So that was the code. You have to go. Don't wait. Run. And so that was the code. And that's the context of this psalm. So we're asking ourselves in that sort of a story, what was it like for young David? Remember, we don't know the exact ages, but this is probably within a year or so after he killed Goliath. So when did he kill Goliath? Well, some chronologists suggest that David killed Goliath when he was 17 years old. And then there are other guesses all the way up to the age of 22. Now, just for our own edification, if there are any young men in here between the ages of 17 and 22, would you stand? Do we have any? All right. They're just children. Thank you, guys. And the king is trying to kill them. Now, how are they supposed to feel about that? Well, of course, confusion. That's how you feel about that. Like, why is this happening to me? I'm just a kid. Why would the king want to kill me? And fear and aloneness and offended justice. Like, this just isn't right. And yet, a core of faith. So let's break that down. What does it feel like for you to see evil spirits in your orbit of acquaintance, scheming to trap you in some pattern of untruth or unlove, because they are always scheming to trap you in untruth and unlove, to press you to feel anxious and depressed? How do you like that? How do you like it when these evil spirits are inspiring the people around you that you care about to do destructive behaviors and have destructive attitudes? How do you like that? How do you like it when these evil spirits are trying to undermine your best career and financial prospects? How do you like it when they're trying to assault your health? Because they do. And so how do you feel about it? Well, confusion, loneliness, offended justice, fear, but I hope also a core of faith. All right, so that's how he feels in this context. Let's hear it from the Psalms. Psalm 59, verse 1. Deliver me from my enemies. He's 17 to 22 years old. Lord, deliver me from my enemies. Oh, my God. Defend me from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from the workers of iniquity and save me from bloody men. For see, they lie in wait, ambush, for my soul. The mighty are gathered against me, not for my transgression. I didn't do anything wrong, nor for my sin, O Lord. They run and prepare themselves without my fault. I didn't do it. Awake to help me, and behold, you, therefore, O Lord God of hosts, the God of Israel, awake. to visit all the Gentiles, because Saul is acting like a Gentile here. Why is he doing this? To visit all the Gentiles. Do not be merciful to any wicked transgressors. Selah, think about that. They return at evening. So imagine, they're watching his house. He's watching them watch his house. He says, they return at evening. They make a noise like a dog growling. So he's watching them watch his house. And they're whispering and they're talking. They make a noise like a dog growling. They go around the city. They've been looking for me besides at my front door. They go around the city. Behold, they belch out with their mouth. They're so awful, the things they're saying. And swords are in their lips. They're trying to harm innocent people. For they say, who hears? You know, I can say whatever I want. We're sneaking around here. Who hears? But you, O Lord, shall laugh at them. You shall have all the Gentiles in ridicule. He might be referring here to, it is a little bit funny that Saul's men were fooled by the mannequin in the bed, right? It's kind of funny. It's scary, but still kind of funny. And so you, O Lord, shall laugh at them. You shall have all the Gentiles in ridicule. Because of his strength, I will wait upon you, for God is my defense. Verse 10, the God of my mercy shall prevent me. That's so great. The word prevent, I didn't change that for you into updated vocabulary, because in Hebrew, we cannot tell if it means the Lord. We know he's in front of us, but we don't know if he's coming toward us. Like, look, here comes the cavalry. The Lord is coming. Or he might be in front of us and preparing the way. In other words, like a blocker on a football team prepares the way for the running back. So which is it? Is the Lord the scout going before us and clearing the way? Or is the Lord coming toward us as our helper? Yes, you know, help is on the way. Don't know. So either it means the Lord is coming to me or the Lord is going before me preparing the way. But at any rate, the God of my mercy, the Lord is going to have mercy sent to me. And the God of my mercy is right up there ahead of me. In verse 11, do not kill them, Lord, lest my people forget. Scatter them by your power, and everybody will remember for all their lives. And bring them down, O Lord, our shield. For the sin of their mouth and the words of their lips, let them even be taken in their pride, like captured in a trap. Let them be trapped in their pride, and for their cursing and lying, which they speak. In verse 13, consume them in your anger. Consume them so that they may not be. Take them out of the picture. And let them know that God rules in Jacob unto the ends of the earth. Think about that, Selah. And at evening, let them return. And let them make a noise like a dog. They're growling. And go around the city, but not finding. Let them wander up and down for food and growl if they are not satisfied. They looked and looked, but they couldn't find me. And let them growl if they're not satisfied. Verse 16, but I will sing of your power. Yes, I will sing aloud of your mercy in the morning. For you have been my defense and refuge in the day of my trouble. Unto you, O my strength, I will sing. For God is my defense, the God of my mercy. And that's how the psalm goes. So what was it like for David? That gives you some of the emotion, the passion of what it was like. Now, you just have to see before we leave this idea, the 11th psalm as well. Because most Bible readers think the 11th psalm probably goes about the same time in young David's life. And we think that especially because Psalm 11, verse 1, you see in yellow font there, says, in the Lord I put my trust. And listen to this. How do you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? You got to go. See, it sounds just like what Jonathan told David. You got to get out of here like a bird. Run and go far away. So remember, these were Jonathan's words to David in 1 Samuel 19. Jonathan told David, my father seeks to kill you. Now, therefore, remain in a secret place and hide yourself. And Jonathan double checked to make sure his father is homicidal. And then he says in chapter 20, verse 37 to the young man, make haste, hurry, don't delay, go. And then in the psalm, how do you say to my soul, run, fly away like a bird and get to your mountain because it's not safe around here anymore. The 11th psalm is short, just one slide, but here's what the entire 11th psalm sounds like. In the Lord I put my trust. How do you say to my soul, as Jonathan said it, flee as a bird to your mountain. For see the wicked men bend their bow. They make ready their arrow upon the string, that they may secretly shoot at the upright in heart. So he's watching them watch his house to ambush him, and they have archery. He says it's just wrong. In verse 3, if the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? This is so great. Look, Lord, what am I supposed to do? There's no fairness in this world. What am I supposed to do? And the answer is, flee to your mountain. If there's not going to be truth, if there's not going to be love, what's left? And sometimes you feel like that, right? So I got to go. In verse 4, the Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, his eyes are watching. His eyelids try the children of men. The Lord tries the righteous, but the wicked and him who loves violence, God's soul hates. This is the hate of God. God's soul hates. Upon the wicked he shall rain snares, fire and brimstone, and a horrible tempest. This shall be the portion of their cup. They have to drink that. For the righteous Lord loves righteousness. His face observes the upright. All right, so these two psalms are telling us, describing for us, what it must have felt like for David, 17 to 22 years old, to be in that situation where he's watching people watch his house and they want to kill him when he walks out in the morning. So what does it feel like? Well, it feels like confusion and fear. You can imagine David saying, you know, why is this happening? And remember, for an Israelite to die young, if he walks out of the house at 17 to 22 years old and they shoot him with arrows from the bushes and kill him, that is a big problem if you have Jewish theology. Because one of the things that the Jewish people were always promised is that if you corporately live well, you'll have a long life. But if you're a sinner, all bets are off. Now, of course, David was righteous, but it looked like he might die young. And for him, that was a frightening thought, because to die young might mean that God is mad at you. And so he doesn't like the thought of being 17 to 22 years old, having people outside his house ready to ambush him. Like, what does that say about me? Has God forsaken me? See the problem. In verse 1 of the 59th Psalm, notice in the green font, deliver me, defend me, deliver me, save me. In verse 3, they lie in ambush. They're like a dog growling. Like, this is, why are they doing this? You hear the confusion. In chapter 11, in green font, flee as a bird to your mountain. Why? I didn't do anything wrong. Why is this happening to me? They bend their bow. They put their arrow on the string. They secretly shoot at me. I didn't do anything wrong. And if the foundations are destroyed, what's left? I mean, if there's no justice, there's no integrity, there's no compassion, what's left? What are you supposed to do? All I can do is run to the mountains. And that, of course, is exactly what he does. But we have the same problem today, right? I mean, it's not like the psalm is irrelevant for us, even though we don't have men outside our house trying to ambush us. What about us? Why should valuable Christian workers ever die young or live in pain? Like, Lord, that's a really fine young Christian man or young Christian woman. Why do they have to die young? Why do they have to live like that in pain? Why should truly deserving believers ever get overlooked in their careers? Like, Lord, he's a good guy. Why is he being overlooked? We had friends in the Air Force when we first moved to Virginia, and we found out that this pilot was being overlooked for promotion because his group of pilots would have these parties that were immoral, and it would be expected that he would join in with, you know, the stripper present and everything, and he was just uncomfortable. He didn't want to get drunk. He didn't want to be around strippers, so he didn't go to their parties. And because of that, he was kind of blacklisted. So why should that ever happen? Like, I didn't do anything wrong. Why is this happening to me in my career? Why should ardent lovers of the Savior ever have demeaning spouses and children? Like, that is a really nice lady. Why is she married to such a miserable man? That is so unfair. Or that's a really nice man. Why is he married to such a miserable woman? That is so unfair. Or these are nice parents. Why do they have kids who act like that? Like, why does this ever have to happen? Why should a truly faithful Christian ever be upstaged by a charming compromiser, even in the church? Why are the largest television ministries and megachurch ministries, often led by unsavory characters. Lord, why should this be the case? Why don't you take somebody who's a real straight arrow and has a real heart for you and put them in front of a basketball stadium? Put that guy on TV. Why is it that that's not happening? Why? It's confusion. It's fear. Like, oh, Lord, what's going on here? It doesn't make sense to me. Why should a Christian lover of children ever have to be childless? She just wanted to have children all the time, and now she can't have a child. Now, this person over here is going to the abortion clinic to get rid of her baby, and this person loves you, and they want to raise children, have no children. Confusion. Like, I don't get it. Why should a rascal ever have more second chances than a person of integrity? Like, that guy, he keeps getting all the lucky breaks, so to speak. Why? He's not even a good guy. Now, this guy over here, he needs a break, but he doesn't get the break. It's confusing. It's fear. There's aloneness. And this psalm is relevant because we've all felt this before. It's like David, 17 to 22 years old, against the whole world. Why should it be like this? There's aloneness. Chapter 59 of Psalms. Deliver me from my enemies, O my God, defend me. For the mighty have gathered against me. I'm a kid. And you have these mighty people who are trying to hurt me. I'm just a kid. Why are they doing this? And not just one mighty person, but many mighty. He's the king. He has the entire nation. In 1 Samuel 19, remember? Saul, King Saul, sought to strike David into the wall with a javelin. And then he sent his messengers to David's house to watch him and to kill him. And in Green Font again from chapter 20, verse 33, it was determined of his father to kill David. And so Jonathan says, make haste, hurry, don't stay. You got to go. Why? It's me against the world. And sometimes that's the way it's going to have to be. This psalm is relevant because you live in a world in which Christian males, especially of one particular race, are routinely vilified, even though they have changed the world for the better, for Christ's sake. Why? Why are we alone? Why are we the villains? We didn't do it. Christian homeschool students and their families are routinely looked down upon in society. Why? They didn't do anything wrong. Christian creationists are routinely discriminated against in the educational system. Why? I mean, does this have to be me against the whole university? It's very uncomfortable. Christian advocates for family ethics and strong work ethic are routinely called out, shouted down, or marginalized in the political marketplace. Like, why? We're trying to protect the families. We're trying to protect the Christian work ethic. It's been good for America. We don't want it to go away. Christian homemakers are routinely shamed by society. Oh, so you don't work? Yes, I work really hard. I'm raising the next generation for Jesus. Christians are routinely regarded as pests and fools by Hollywood, the Ivy League, Washington, D.C., and sometimes their own family members. Oh, yeah, you know, my brother and his family, they're wacko. I don't really talk to my son anymore. He went off the deep end. Why? It's just so unfair. The David against the world scenario. It's true of all of us sometimes. And then there's offended justice. Like, this is just so wrong. You know, why is it like this? Offended justice. There should be punishment for something like this. Again, in green font, from the 59th Psalm, deliver me from the workers of iniquity. These people are trying to be bad. In green font again, they're bloody men. They're violent. They're trying to hurt me. In verse 3, not for my transgression or my sin. I didn't do it. I didn't do anything wrong. And it's without my fault. It's not my fault. I didn't do it. Awake to visit all the Gentiles. Do not be merciful to any wicked transgressors. Lord, you have to do something. They deserve to be punished. Bring them down. Scatter them. Bring them down. For the sin of their mouth, let them be taken, captured in their own trap. For cursing and lying. I mean, why are they wishing me bad? To curse somebody means I wish God would give you bad things, lots of bad things. Why are they cursing? Why are they lying? None of this is true. In verse 13, consume them in wrath so that they may not be. Lord, please just take them out of the picture. Please take them out of my life. Take them away. In the 11th Psalm, verse 2, the wicked shoot the upright. It's just not right. This is wrong. Even if it were happening to somebody else, it offends my sense of justice and there should be punishment here. And once again, this psalm is not irrelevant, right? Offended justice. It would only be right for the educational system to be disbanded and reorganized with public apologies for their recent activism in the areas of anti-family, anti-Christian, anti-supernatural, and anti-equality biases and policies. That's what's right. I don't think that's going to happen. But we should feel offended at that. That's just wrong. It's wrong that in the world of business and banking, we have dissimilar interest rates for savings accounts and credit cards. So you're going to charge me 19% interest on my credit card and you're going to give me 4% interest on my savings account. That's just wrong. It's wrong. Abusing their workers in favor of C-suite officers and stockholders. Oh, so in other words, we're going to lay off 100 employees that we said were part of our, corporate family. We're going to lay them off because there are some very poor people in another country who will do the job for pennies. And we're just going to throw these people under the bus because that way the C-suite officers, CEO, CFO, COO, the C-suite officers are going to have more profit and the stockholders who are saving money for their, next beach home or whatever, we're going to take care of them. We're going to throw all the employees under the bus that we just called part of our company family. Really? That's just wrong. Marketing unethical drugs and food additives. Why are you doing that? That's just wrong. Conspiring with the educational system to raise tuition rates and student loan debts to oppressive levels. It's just wrong. Why are you doing that? Rewarding insiders in the stock market. Conspiring with the healthcare system to make oppressive insurance rates non-optional. Like, what are we supposed to do here? The legal system should be ashamed and they should apologize for legalizing infanticide and non-traditional marriage. That's wrong. You should be ashamed of yourselves and you should apologize publicly. And they should be ashamed of themselves and apologize for incentivizing large payouts for fraudulent and exaggerated claims. Why are you doing that? That's wrong. Everybody should straighten up and apologize publicly. And the politicians should be ashamed and apologize for all of these things because they're causing it all. So it's just offended justice. But in spite of all this, notice that there's this core of faith in the Psalms. And this is beautiful. So again, watching the green font. You, O Lord, shall laugh at them. You shall have all the Gentiles in ridicule. Like someday we're going to laugh about this. That's what we always say, right? That's true. The Lord is going to laugh about this. Like, you've got to be kidding. In green font, God is my defense. The God of my mercy shall prevent. He's going to either come and meet me or he's going to go ahead of me and clear the way. The God of my mercy shall prevent me. God shall let me see my desire upon my enemies. I will sing. You'll see. I will sing aloud of your mercy. My defense and refuge, the Lord has been my defense and refuge in my trouble. I will sing, for God is my defense and he is the God of my mercy. And in the 11th Psalm, in the Lord I put my trust. In green font again, his eyes try the children of men. He knows. He knows what's happening here. The wicked and him who loves violence, the Lord's soul hates. In verse 6, he will rain snares, fire and brimstone, and a horrible tempest. His face observes the upright. You see the core of faith. Even though everything is so rotten right now, they're surrounding my house to kill me. But I think the Lord is my defense, my refuge, and you watch. We're going to laugh about this someday, and we're going to see that the Lord always takes care of the upright. We sometimes have this little idea in mind that while we have moments of panic, look, they're surrounding my house, moments of panic, the Christian life is marked by years of calm. And that's so great. So remember Betsy Ten Boom's Psalms Life. there's a lot of trouble there. And her trouble is a lot like David's, right? Because she actually had Nazi guards surrounding her house. So we don't exactly have that. Our most consequential enemies for most of us are invisible. But Betsy had the real thing. But notice what her life was like. These are Betsy Ten Boom quotes. Now, remember, that's a pretty hard life, right? Look what she says. Her biographer says, "More and more, the distinction between prayer and the rest of life seemed to be vanishing for Betsy. She just prayed all the time. She's doing fine." When a shell went off and exploded in the bed next to where Corey was sleeping, Corey wasn't there because Betsy was in the kitchen rattling around, and it was late, and Corey went down to see what was happening. Because Corey went down to see what Betsy was doing, when the bomb went off, it didn't hurt Corey. And Corey started to say, "If I had not heard you in the kitchen, I would be dead." That's what she was going to say. "So don't say it, Corey," Betsy says. "There are no ifs in God's world, and no places that are safer than other places. The center of his will is our only safety. Oh, Corey, let us pray that we may always know it." See, she's living the Psalms life, but see the core of faith. When they were at Ravensbrook before Betsy died, they were watching this female prison guard mercilessly beat one of the prisoners. And in watching that, Corey says, "Oh, the poor woman." And Betsy says, "Yes, may God forgive her." And then Corey realized that Betsy was talking about the poor guard woman. And may God forgive her for what she's doing. Pretty tough to love your enemies enough to say, "Poor thing." And then at the end, just before she died, Betsy told Corey, "We must tell the people what we've learned here at Ravensbrook concentration camp. We must tell them that there is no pit so deep that he is not deeper still. They'll listen to us, Corey, because we have been there." And so pretty tough, right? That's Betsy's Psalms life. What about your Psalms life? Do you realize your life was right on the brink of being so much better than it is? Right on the brink. For example, at your fingertips, almost, you would have had stronger bonds with your family, with your loved ones, with your church family, with your neighbors. You almost achieved that. You know how close you've been to that so many times in your life. Almost, you had a more compassionate economic system of capitalism. Not cold, mean capitalism, but where Christian love affects what the bosses are deciding. Almost, you would have had in the United States greater security from crime and from war, global threats and terrorism. Almost. That was at our fingertips as a nation and as individuals. Almost, we would have had a more pleasant and wholesome education experience. We had the tools. It could have been. It should have been. Almost, we would have had a more healthful food supply and a more compassionate health care system. It's been like at our fingertips for decades. And in your life as individuals, almost, this was you. And then what has really happened? Well, different things with our health, different things with our family, different things with war and terrorism and crime, and different things with educational experiences and all that. You almost had it, but beyond the devil's own personal attacks, which are substantial, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. But beyond that, as Ephesians 2:2 says it, the spirit that now works in the children of disobedience, that's the devil. The spirit that now works in the children of disobedience, that spirit has inspired the people around you to deceive, neglect, grab, take, and trample. And how does that make you feel? Not great, right? But what you're going to have in your life as a follower of Jesus, moments of panic. "Look, those crazy people are surrounding my house to kill me, and they're growling like mean dogs." Moments of panic, but years of calm. And here's what it sounded like then, right? "But you, O Lord, shall laugh. God is my defense. The God of my mercy shall come before me, meet me. You have been my refuge in the day of my trouble. I will sing, for God is my defense and the God of my mercy." a core of faith in spite of the ambush.